This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, with stories from Recent Week magazines. The World at a Glance, Ottawa, Oil to Asia, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith agreed to work together to build a pipeline from oil-rich Alberta province to the Pacific coast for export to Asia. Smith said such a pipeline could move more than 1 million barrels per day to the Asian market, ensuring that our province and our country are no longer dependent on just one customer to buy our most valuable resource. At least one cabinet minister resigned over the plan, which would violate Canada's clean energy regulations. But Carney said the pipeline was necessary if the country is to meet his government's goal of doubling non-U.S. exports in the next decade. Over 95% of all our energy exports went to the states, Carney said. This tight interdependence, once a strength, is now a weakness. Bern, Switzerland. No billionaire tax. Swiss voters overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to impose a 50% inheritance tax on the super rich. The ballot measure, brought by the far-left Young Socialists, a youth wing of the Social Democrats, would have applied to heirs of fortunes worth $62 million and up. The Young Socialists wanted the money to go toward mitigating climate change. Opponents argued that such a massive wealth tax would undermine Switzerland's prosperity, and many of Switzerland's numerous billionaires had threatened to leave the country if the measure passed. Nearly 79% voted no. Frederick Rochat of Swiss bank Lombard Odier said the clear result showed Swiss common sense had prevailed. Switzerland has the most millionaires per capita, with 145 per 1,000 adults, and vies with Luxembourg and Hong Kong for the most billionaires. Saint-Étienne, France. Dirty politics. The mayor of Saint-Étienne was sentenced to 4 years in prison for trying to use a sex tape to coerce another politician into agreeing not to run against him. The court found that Mayor Gaël Perdriau had set up his rival Gilles Artigues, a conservative Catholic married to a woman with a male escort, in a Paris hotel room. Perdriau has been barred from public office for 5 years. One of his former deputies, Sami Kefi Jérôme, admitted to placing a concealed camera in the hotel room where the 2015 encounter took place, and said he got his instructions from the mayor's chief of staff. The order was to trap Gilles Artigues over his repressed homosexuality, Kefi Jérôme said. Paris, bring back brothels. French far-right leader Jordan Bardella endorsed a proposal to make brothels legal, denouncing what he called the hypocrisy of forcing sex workers to operate in secret. Prostitution was legal in France until 2016, although pimping or running a brothel was not, but a law passed that year outlawed paying for sex and imposed fines on clients. While sex workers were still free to sell their services, their trade was driven underground, making it more dangerous for them. Bardella's National Rally Party now plans to introduce legislation that would allow brothels to open as cooperatives run by the sex workers themselves. We can set up secure and closed spaces to prevent this activity from taking place in unsanitary and unsafe conditions, said Bardella, 30. It's a safety issue. London. Trump sues BBC. President Trump filed a $10 billion defamation lawsuit against the BBC, accusing the British national broadcaster of editing a speech he gave on January 6, 2021, to make it appear as though he told supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol. the BBC pushed out two top executives last month after an internal review concluded its Panorama TV program had unfairly spliced two clips, one of Trump urging people to the Capitol, the other telling them to fight like hell, that occurred 54 minutes apart. The lawsuit, filed in Miami after the deadline expired in the UK, is Trump's latest demand for massive payouts from media outlets he says are biased against him. The network apologized but said there was no basis for a defamation claim. Berlin. Progress on Ukraine. After meeting in Berlin, Ukrainian, U.S., and European negotiators said they were close to hammering out a joint proposal to end the nearly four-year Russian war in Ukraine. The deal would see a European-led military force, supported by the U.S., which presumably means U.S. intelligence assistance but no American troops, serving as peacekeepers inside Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine was willing to abandon pursuit of NATO membership because the U.S. said it would give security guarantees that are equivalent to Article 5 of the NATO partners. But sticking points remain, including where to draw the Ukrainian-Russian border in the east, where Russia has conquered large swaths of territory. And of course, Russia has yet to agree to any part of the proposal. Lima, migrant emergency. Peruvian President Jose Heri announced a state of emergency on the border to block the entrance of migrants fleeing a looming immigration crackdown in neighboring Chile. Hundreds of thousands of people, many of them Venezuelans, had come to Chile in recent years to escape economic and political crises back home. Now, many of them are trying to cross into Peru. Ultra-conservative lawyer José Antonio Kast, who is favored to win Chile's presidential runoff this month, has built his campaign on fears of Venezuelan migrants, and he told undocumented immigrants to get out before he assumes office. "You have 111 days to leave Chile voluntarily," Kast said in a campaign ad filmed on the porous border. "If not, we will stop you, we will detain you, we will expel you. You will leave with only the clothes on your back." Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. A real coup or a fake? A military junta took over Guinea-Bissau just 3 days after a disputed election. The new leader, General Horta Intraa, announced he has chosen as Prime Minister Elidio Vieira Tay, a close ally of deposed President Umaro Toko Mbalo. The general said the coup was necessary to foil a plot by narco-traffickers to capture Guinean democracy, and he promised a transition back to civilian rule in a year. Opposition leader Fernando Diaz, who is now holed up in the Nigerian embassy in Bissau, accused Mbalo of orchestrating a fake coup so he could stay in control by proxy. "He lost the elections," Diaz said, "and instead of accepting the result, he fabricated a coup d'etat." The Electoral Commission said armed men had destroyed the server that stored the election results. Kyiv, Zelensky's number two, out. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's closest advisor and chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, resigned after his home was searched as part of a massive corruption investigation. Yermak, long considered the second most powerful figure in the Ukrainian government, had led negotiations with the Trump administration on ending the war with Russia. He hasn't been charged in connection with the alleged $100 million kickback scheme at the state nuclear energy company, but instead of waiting for the investigation to play out, he abruptly joined the army at age 54. Yermak said he was disgusted by the filth directed at me and was leaving to avoid creating problems for Zelensky. "I'm going to the front," he said. "Maybe we'll see each other again. Glory to Ukraine." Port Sudan, Sudan. Russian base. Sudan's military government has offered Russia a location for its first naval base in Africa, overlooking vital Red Sea shipping routes at Port Sudan, the Wall Street Journal reported. Under the proposed 25-year deal, Russia could station 300 troops and dock up to 4 warships at a spot where it could monitor maritime traffic through the crucial choke point of the Suez Canal. The deal would also give Russia potentially lucrative mining concessions in Africa's third largest gold producer. In exchange, Moscow is expected to provide Su-30 and Su-35 fighter planes for Sudan's military. Having a Red Sea base would give the Russians greater access to the Mediterranean Sea and the Indian Ocean, lending them more international prestige and clout, said retired Air Force Major General Mark Hicks. Seoul, spying on you at home. Hackers hijacked more than 120,000 home security cameras in South Korea and used the footage to make sexually explicit videos, South Korean police said. 4 people were arrested over the scheme, which targeted cameras in homes, karaoke rooms, a Pilates studio, and a gynecologist's office. One suspect allegedly hacked some 63,000 cameras, creating 545 exploitative videos that netted him over $24,000. Another allegedly sold 648 videos gleaned from 70,000 cameras. The National Police Agency reminded people that viewing these videos, not just producing them, is a serious crime that inflicts immense suffering. It also urged people who use home cameras to pick a secure password, change it regularly, and remain vigilant against cybercrime. Once a camera is hacked, one officer said, it is repeatedly targeted. Best columns of the U.S., the invisible sex trafficking scandal. Jeffrey Epstein's victims have finally gotten some of the spotlight they have long been denied, said Matt K. Lewis in the Los Angeles Times, but their stories are far from unique. Thousands of Native American women and girls are victimized by sex traffickers, pedophiles, and murderers while barely registering in public consciousness. Every year, some 5,700 indigenous women and girls go missing. Though under 3% of Americans identify as Native, these groups make up a shocking 40% of all sex trafficking victims. And of the 5,800 who disappeared in 2023, nearly 75% were children. Sexual predation of Native girls and women has a long, ugly history. Poverty and centuries of systemic abuse make them particularly vulnerable and invisible to society, even when kidnapped, sexually assaulted, or murdered. In addition, crimes committed on reservations can occur in a jurisdictional no man's land that often keeps local police and the FBI from investigating. Quite deliberately, predators pick vulnerable people who risk being disbelieved or deemed unworthy of authorities' time and focus. That's even more true of indigenous women and girls than Epstein's mostly white victims. Native American women are tragically still treated by many as disposable characters in the long national narrative. Bannon's secret alliance with Epstein. Many prominent people were embarrassed by the recent release of a trove of emails to and from sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, said Mona Charon in The Bulwark. But while Harvard economist Larry Summers has admitted fault and shame, one of Epstein's frequent correspondents has escaped accountability, MAGA strategist and Trump consigliere Steve Bannon. He exchanged hundreds of emails with the convicted felon, advised Epstein how to handle negative news stories, and conspired to whitewash his public image. When Bannon missed a flight in London, he emailed Epstein, who put him on his private plane and told him, massages not included. The emails suggest that Bannon and Epstein often met in person, with Bannon asking Epstein for access to his Manhattan mansion that's not the front door. Bannon even filmed 15 hours of a documentary that would attempt to redeem Epstein's reputation. Simultaneously, Bannon stoked conspiracy theories that portrayed Democrats as the party of pedophiles. Where is Bannon's acknowledgement of wrongdoing? This self-proclaimed truth teller stands revealed as one of the most cynical liars ever to mar this country. Best Columns International, Canada. Why we must pay for our own defense. It's infuriating to hear Donald Trump and other Republicans accuse Canada of freeloading, said Justin Ling in the Toronto Star, but they've got a point. For decades, American largesse has kept Russian fighter jets out of our skies, freeing us to invest in social programs instead of defense. Now that Uncle Sam has lost his mind under Trump, we've got to plan for a world without him. We're on our way. In a remarkably short time, Canada has set about modernizing its military after letting it rust for decades. On track to hit the old NATO military spending target of 2% of GDP, we are racing toward even loftier goals, pledging an extra $58 billion over 5 years for defense. Rearming will be complex and tricky, and Ottawa's sudden divorce from the U.S. complicates the task. We'll need more bombs and tanks and guns and warships, distasteful as such things are to our peacekeeping sensibilities. The left is already complaining about spending on arms instead of housing or health care. But the expense will be worth it. This isn't about trying to stick it to Trump for his trade war. The U.S. is threatening to annex us and sell out our allies in Ukraine and Taiwan. Authoritarianism is on the march worldwide. We can't respond to any of this without a well-equipped military. Indonesia. With heroes like this, who needs villains? The Indonesian government's naming of the late dictator Suharto as a national hero is simply an insult, said Abdul Khalik in the Jakarta Post. In power from 1967 to 1998, Suharto presided over mass killings and normalized collusion, corruption, and nepotism. But his greatest crime was dehumanizing the Indonesian people, just as the colonial powers in this part of the world did before him. His brutality halted the intellectual and moral growth of Indonesia by destroying its creative mind and critical thinking. Sure, his New Order policies attracted Western investment, and the economy grew 7% a year, but we were left with a society that can't compete and a citizenry that would willingly elect our current president, Prabowo Subianto, an illiberal ex-general who was once married to a Suharto daughter. That Prabowo would honor Suharto as a hero is more than a favor to his former in-laws. It is a blatant attempt to make people believe the lie that the Suharto years were the good old days and that authoritarian rule should be revived, and it will likely work. Indonesians are exhausted by years of a chaotic democracy and disillusioned by unfulfilled promises from leaders who take orders from the same oligarchs. The perceived stability under Suharto appears comfortable, even if that stability was built on fear, repression, and silence. How they see us. Trump bullies the neighborhood. Honduras just got a brutal reminder of how fragile sovereignty can be in the shadow of a superpower, said El Libertador of Honduras in an editorial. On the eve of our presidential election, the abuser Donald Trump declared his support for Nasri Asfura, a right-winger in the model of Trump himself, whose slogan is, "Daddy, at your service. That was sad news for another conservative sportscaster, Salvador Nasralla. He had spent years sucking up to Trump, only to be thrown aside like a discarded banana. The unpredictable U.S. president suddenly began denouncing Nasralla as a borderline communist and threatened to cut off all U.S. aid to Honduras if Asfura didn't win. It's too soon to tell whether the intervention was successful. With ballots still trickling in, some of them carried by donkey down winding mountain paths, Asfura and Nasralla were separated by just a few hundred votes, and there will surely be a recount. Whoever does win, take note. The gringos don't choose heroes, only well-behaved pawns. Honduras isn't the first to suffer Trump's election meddling, said Le Monde of France in an editorial. Remember that during Argentina's recent election, he announced a massive $20 billion aid package conditional on the victory of candidates aligned with President Javier Milei. Trump is intent on controlling events in Latin America, which he considers a U.S. sphere of influence. He clearly wants regime change in Venezuela, said Gregorio Salazar in Tal Cual Digital of Venezuela. He's been claiming to be at war with Venezuelan narco-terrorists for months now and calling leftist President Nicolas Maduro a cartel leader. With Trump's vast military force just off our coast, it looks like the war is about to start in earnest and we have no hope of defense. Corrupt and incompetent, Maduro has made such a heartbreaking ruin of this country that pitting our poorly trained, underpaid, and mistreated armed forces against the U.S. military will be like trying to swim against a tsunami. Yet Trump is undermining his own justification for intervention, said Prensa Libre of Guatemala in an editorial. He claims that the imperative to end drug trafficking means Maduro must go, but he just pardoned his old chum Juan Orlando Hernandez, the Honduran ex-president who was sentenced last year to 45 years in a U.S. prison for drug trafficking. Americans, and especially Republicans, are not likely to approve of such favoritism toward a convicted drug trafficker. Hernandez actually fits the definition of narco-terrorist far better than Maduro, said George Grills in the Times of the UK. This is a guy who once said he wanted to shove the drugs up the noses of the gringos. Hernandez and his brother accepted a hand-delivered $1 million bribe to help a Mexican cartel deliver 400 tons of Colombian cocaine to the U.S. market. But Hernandez gave Trump a fawning letter claiming that he, like Trump, had been persecuted by the Biden administration, and that's all it took. In fact, the Hernandez connection may well be why Trump switched his support to Asfura in the Honduran election, too. Asfura is from Hernandez's party. It's not that Trump hates drug traffickers, it's that he loves right-wing strongmen. Best columns of Europe, United Kingdom. Gen X has been radicalized. Small talk isn't what it used to be, said Gabby Hinsliff in The Guardian. The other day, I was chatting with a supermarket cashier about how she was working overtime to save up for Christmas when the customer behind me chipped in that Finance Minister Rachel Reeves should be taken out before she takes all our money. He said it calmly, as if proposing political assassination were as normal as discussing the weather. Then it clicked. This was a Facebook conversation come to life. At the bus stop or the school gates, it's now common to hear the sort of conspiratorial nonsense that's prevalent on social media about vaccines, minorities, or government surveillance, but that people were once too embarrassed to say in public. And it's not grumpy pensioners or teenage boys who are spouting this internet bile, it's Gen Xers. My generation used to be the peacekeepers of the culture wars, too young to be reactionary and too old to be woke. But we've been radicalized in our midlife crisis years, embracing conspiracy theories and populist politics as we worry about being left behind in a changing world. Gen X spent years fretting about how online life might hurt our kids. We should have been just as concerned about what the great unregulated free speech experiment was doing to our own brains. France, ready to let our kids go to war? France is finally having a serious conversation about Europe's new security reality, said an editorial in Le Monde. President Emmanuel Macron announced the creation of a paid 10-month voluntary military service for young adults. France ended conscription in 1997 following the collapse of the Soviet Union, but the risk that Russia's war in Ukraine might spill over to NATO members is forcing us to again expand citizen engagement in defense. While Macron didn't mention Russia in his announcement, he noted that France cannot remain immobile while its European allies are taking steps against a threat that weighs on us all. The president insisted the new service would apply only on national territory, an attempt to soothe a panic triggered by Army Chief Fabien Mandon's recent warning that France should be prepared to lose children in a potential future conflict. Still, the plan to bring 3,000 volunteers into the military next year should make the possibility of a major war in Western Europe concrete for a public that hasn't had to worry about such matters for decades. Some pundits may dismiss Macron's announcement as the move of a weakened and unpopular president who wants to present himself as a unifier. But it is the president's duty to foster collective awareness of a dangerous situation, especially one that grows more dangerous by the day. Ukraine deal, a Trump business opportunity. The Kremlin's pitch to President Trump and his inner circle is simple. Peace through business, said Drew Hinshaw in the Wall Street Journal. And it looks like Trump and his cronies are on board. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, Trump's longtime golf buddy and now the lead U.S. negotiator for an end to Russia's war on Ukraine, has joined Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner for peace talks with Kirill Dmitriev, the U.S.-educated head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund. The plan, cooked up by Moscow, is designed to subjugate Ukraine, weaken its military, and bring Russia's $2 trillion economy in from the cold, and share the proceeds with Americans in Trump's orbit. Dmitriev and Trump's envoys discussed deploying $300 billion in frozen Russian assets toward both the reconstruction of Ukraine and joint U.S.-Russian projects, including reviving the sabotaged Nord Stream pipeline. Russian oligarchs have been quietly pursuing deals with Trump mega-donors and allies involving natural gas development, rare earth mining, and even joint Russia-U.S. missions to Mars through Elon Musk's SpaceX. Witkoff is openly acting as a Russian tool, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. Bloomberg published excerpts from a leaked transcript of mid-October calls that confirmed the 28-point peace plan Trump initially proposed was in fact largely a Kremlin product. Witkoff, who like Trump is a real estate mogul with long-standing ties to Russian mobsters, counseled Kremlin foreign policy advisor Yuri Ushakov to have Putin call Trump and woo him with flattery about his peacemaking skills. Days after the call from Putin, Trump decided not to equip Ukraine with long-range Tomahawk cruise missiles. For U.S. investors, big Russian deals rarely work out, said Ben Smith in Semaphore. Corruption and Putin's imperial ambitions inevitably get in the way. British-American financier Bill Browder, who was deported from Russia after criticizing its corruption, said it is the stupidest thing ever to think the Russians will let Americans get a single penny out of these deals. What is unfolding is not a negotiation at all, said Alexander Vindman in his Substack newsletter, but a successful Russian influence operation. For Trump and his pals, the lure of personal profit is so strong that they're willing to support Russia's maximalist demands, including Ukraine surrendering land it has not lost. The betrayal of Ukraine is a signal to adversaries worldwide that American policy is for sale. Technology. Google, now an AI chip company. Google is threatening NVIDIA's grip on the AI hardware sector, said Dave Lee in Bloomberg. It was revealed that Meta has been in talks to buy billions of dollars worth of artificial intelligence processing chips, not from NVIDIA, the $4.3 trillion behemoth whose chips have powered the AI boom, but instead from Google. The following day's stock reaction, a pullback of 2.6% for NVIDIA and a 1.6% gain for Google, was a telling sign, as was NVIDIA's defensive post on X, which stated that it was delighted by Google's success, but that its own chips are a generation ahead of the industry. That may be true, but rivals are coming on fast. As well as Google's Ironwood chips, Amazon is also making strides with its own AI chips, Trainium and Inferentia. Until last week, NVIDIA investors worried most that demand for AI hardware might fall. Now they also worry some of that could be poached. Google's chip breakthrough has been more than a decade in the making, said Dina Bass and Emily Forgash, also in Bloomberg. The company started developing so-called tensor processing units, TPUs, in 2013 to speed up the company's web search engine and boost efficiency. While NVIDIA's graphics processing units, GPUs, have since become the gold standard in the AI market, skyrocketing demand for them has also made them pricey and chronically in short supply, opening the door for Google. The popularity of NVIDIA's chips partly lies in the CUDA software platform that comes with them, said The Economist. The software, which helps programmers, is intended to cater to a wide range of applications, whereas the software surrounding TPUs has been created with Google's own products in mind. That may determine how many customers actually switch away from NVIDIA. Still, it's been a good run for Google, said Hayden Field in The Verge. Its newly released AI model Gemini 3, powered by its TPUs, blows past OpenAI and other competitors' products on a range of benchmarks to such a degree that even OpenAI CEO Sam Altman and Elon Musk publicly congratulated the Gemini team on a job well done. Once considered a laggard in the AI race, Google is now looking like a combination of OpenAI and Microsoft with a bit of NVIDIA thrown in, said Dan Gallagher in the Wall Street Journal. It has made significant strides with advanced models and chips, while also keeping its core business, advertising, humming. Investors, including Warren Buffett, have taken notice, and Google's stock has surged, while Microsoft, Oracle, NVIDIA, and Meta have seen double-digit declines since late October. It's as if someone forgot to tell Google about the whole AI bubble thing. The Book List in Short Story Collections. The 11th Hour by Salman Rushdie. Salman Rushdie's 2022 Brush with Death renders his latest stories all the more potent and poignant, said Malcolm Forbes in the Los Angeles Times. Though never doom-laden, all five tales in this inventive and engrossing collection are death-tinged, and two feature characters who hover in a limited state between life and death. Rushdie also keeps his stories more streamlined than his recent novels have been, limiting his fanciful touches to subtle strokes of color. A Different Kind of Tension by Jonathan Lethem. Jonathan Lethem's new book is both an introduction and a summation, said Justin St. Clair in the Los Angeles Review of Books. It collects 30 of the Motherless Brooklyn novelist's best stories, stretching from 1990 to 2024, and shows him more than willing to ignore the limitations of realism. He gives us talking animals, modern fables, touches of science fiction, and the results prove compelling. A career retrospective befitting one of our most perceptive and agile contemporary writers. The Pelican Child by Joy Williams. It would be tempting to describe The Pelican Child as an American allegory in the Trumpian era, said Hamilton Kane in the Boston Globe. But the collection is also Joy Williams's romp across the story form, a collection of painterly and provocative tales that are rooted in an American West we know, but one that's often slipping beyond the frame of reality. At 81, she's still flavoring her work with piercing observations, a pinch of irony, and her signature moxie. She's still got it. Near Flesh by Catherine Dunn. Catherine Dunn's pieces have an almost irrepressible kinetic energy, said Alexandra Kleeman in the New York Times. In this posthumous book, the geek love author's first story collection, protagonists come out swinging at obstacles both real and psychological, and situations that other authors might render through internal monologue are expressed as eruptions of action. Brief as some stories are, they cut to the quick of life and highlight the struggle for survival even in cultivated spaces. Review of film, Rush Hour's Return, a triumph of Trumpian taste. Donald Trump has just effected one of the strangest imaginable uses of presidential power, said Miles Klee in Rolling Stone. If the reporting in a November 23rd Semaphore story is correct, the president is such a fan of the Rush Hour buddy cop action franchise that he pressured his billionaire supporter Larry Ellison to revive the series and was quickly given his wish. However it happened, a Rush Hour 4 is now in the works with Paramount, a recent Ellison family acquisition, signed on to distribute. Co-stars Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan are also allegedly on board, though it remains to be seen whether Chan can still perform martial arts stunts at 71, and whether the Rush Hour brand of racial humor will hold the same appeal it did for audiences nearly 30 years ago. So now we find ourselves in a situation where the President of the United States is dictating the sort of films that should be made, said Stuart Heritage in The Guardian. And making the situation worse is that Trump has famously awful taste in movies. Jackie Chan has made some great movies, for example, but clearly Trump much prefers the ones where Chan has to deliberately dumb himself down for Western audiences who chew popcorn with their mouths open. Trump's motivation for pushing Rush Hour likely has nothing at all to do with his affection for the movie, said Monica Hesse in the Washington Post. Rather, it's his admiration for the franchise's director, Brett Ratner, who was dropped by Warner Brothers in 2017 after several women accused him of sexual harassment or misconduct. Ratner has since buddied up to Trump, even ending his fallow period by directing a forthcoming documentary about Melania Trump. By prodding Paramount to resurrect Rush Hour, Trump gets to help a friend and also dunk on cancel culture. To him, it's a win-win. Television streaming tips, the year's top offbeat comedy films. Ephus, A baseball movie as quirky and meandering as the pitch it's named for, this delightful slow curve of a comedy follows locals playing the final game of a soon-to-be torn-up field. Laughs and love of the game ensue. Mubi. If I had legs, I'd kick you. Rose Byrne is a mom spiraling into a breakdown as she endures the mounting stresses of her husband's absence, a sick daughter, and a massive hole in her apartment's ceiling. Byrne's performance is one of the best of her career. $20 on demand. Sister Midnight, director Karan Kandhari's stylishly eccentric dark comedy, blends genres and influences into a unique pleasure. Radhika Apte gives an enrapturing comic performance as a Mumbai housewife driven to feral behavior by an unhappy arranged marriage. Hulu. The Ballad of Wallace Island. A lottery winner with a punny sense of humor pays his favorite indie folk duo to reunite for a private concert at his home on a sea-sprayed Welsh island, generating plenty of cringy moments and some beautiful music. Tom Basden, Tim Key, and Carey Mulligan make a terrific comic trio. $6 on demand. Splitsville. Marriages go off the rails in hilarious fashion in this great ensemble comedy about open relationships, infidelity, and other crossed boundaries. Adria Arjona, Dakota Johnson, Kyle Marvin, and Michelangelo Covino play the farce to the hilt. $6 on demand. The Last Word, That Old-Time Religion. The pews of Orthodox churches across the U.S. are filling up with new converts, said Ruth Graham in the New York Times, young men hungry for a more demanding and masculine form of Christianity. Something is changing in an otherwise quiet corner of Christianity in the United States, one that prides itself on how little it has changed over time. Priests are swapping stories about record attendance numbers. Older members are adjusting, or not, to the influx of new attendees. Parishes are strategizing about how to accommodate more prospective converts than existing clergy can reasonably handle on their own. Across the country, the ancient tradition of Orthodox Christianity is attracting energetic new adherents, especially among conservative young men. They are drawn to what they describe as a more demanding, even difficult, practice of Christianity. Echoing some of the rhetoric of the so-called manosphere, new waves of young converts say Orthodoxy offers them hard truths and affirms their masculinity. In the whole history of the Orthodox Church in America, this has never been seen, the very Reverend Andrew Damick, an Antiochian Orthodox priest and author in eastern Pennsylvania, said of the large groups of young people showing up at many parishes. This is new ground for everyone. In the U.S., Orthodox Christianity is by far the smallest and least known of the three major branches of Christianity, representing about 1% of the population, compared with about 40% who are Protestant and 20% who are Catholic. Orthodox pews here have historically been occupied by immigrants from Ukraine, Greece, and other countries with large Orthodox populations. Their American-born children often drift to other churches, but a homegrown Orthodox Christianity is strikingly emergent. Many of the young Americans new to the pews have been introduced to Orthodoxy by hard-edge influencers on YouTube and other social media platforms. Critics call the enthusiastic young converts ortho bros. One night this summer, the young adults of All Saints Orthodox Church in Raleigh, North Carolina, gathered at a bookshop and bar on the city's north side. At the event's peak, there were a mere handful of women present and more than 40 men. The men noticed and believed they knew why. Orthodoxy appeals to the masculine soul, said Josh Elkins, a student at North Carolina State University, who was chatting with other young men. The Orthodox Church is the only church that really coaches men hard and says, "This is what you need to do," said Elkins, 20, who casually quoted a second-century martyr and rattled off terms like monarchical episcopate in conversation. He beamed as he talked about the weekly worship service known as the Divine Liturgy, an hours-long affair at which attendees typically stand the entire time rather than sitting in the pews or kneeling. The Divine Liturgy is just one aspect of Orthodox faith and practice that is unfamiliar to many Americans, including other Christians. Orthodox services include chanting, incense, and genuflecting deeply before painted icons. Much of the liturgy takes place out of the sight of the congregation. The church also maintains a strict and complicated schedule of fasting. "It's so much harder than I thought it was going to be," said Matthew Herman Hudson, 29, who converted in his early 20s and works in the Raleigh bookstore. "But it speaks to me in a way that nothing else ever did." Generation Z is upending the expectations of many scholars and faith leaders who watched the country steadily secularizing for decades, with each generation less religious than the last. Some recent surveys suggest that young adult men are defying that trend. The Orthodox Church traces its ecclesiastical lineage to Jesus Christ and the early apostles. As Christianity expanded in its first millennium, a theological and political divide opened between the Eastern Church and the Western, or Roman Catholic, Church. A schism in the 11th century over issues including papal authority divided the two bodies definitively, with Eastern Orthodoxy flourishing in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and Russia. Orthodox Christians in the U.S. are younger and more male than many other Christian groups here. More than 60% of them are men, compared with 46% of evangelicals, according to the Pew Research Center. Orthodox Christians are also much younger, with 24% of adult adherents younger than 30, compared with 14% of evangelicals. The gaps are the same as those between Orthodox Christians and Catholics. Some converts report approvingly that Orthodoxy has a more masculine feel than other traditions. Priests, who must be male and can marry, often have large beards and big families. Orthodoxy asks practitioners to make sacrifices like fasting rather than offering them emotional contemporary music and therapeutic sermons, which critics describe as the typical evangelical megachurch experience. "There's no war for us to die in." Well, there are wars for us to die in, just not ones that are honorable, said Larrick Copes, Jr., 28, who attends All Saints. For former Protestants like himself, Orthodoxy serves as a kind of frontier of exploration, he said. "Young men need purpose, whatever that is," said Jared Stein, 26. "Young men are struggling to find jobs, they're struggling to get into schools, and they're really being told by society, 'We don't really need you.'" Stein and Copes used to attend the same evangelical megachurch, but lost track of each other when the church collapsed in scandal. They reconnected for the first time in years at the Orthodox gathering at the bookstore. The new energy in many Orthodox parishes tracks with broader trends among young men embracing harder edge and more intense versions of several Christian traditions. In the Catholic Church, a significant minority of young people prefer the pre-Vatican II traditional Latin Mass and attend parishes where women wear veils to Mass. These remain relatively small religious subcultures, but they are part of a shift that enthusiastic observers are calling a revival. Pew Research found this year that after years of decline, the Christian population in the U.S. has been stable for several years, a change fueled in part by young adults. Some argue that the common denominator in churches attracting young people is not their style of worship, but their treatment of the supernatural. Damick, the priest in Pennsylvania, pointed out that charismatic Christianity, whose theology includes an openness to faith healing and spiritual warfare, has also resisted trends of religious decline. You're much more likely to see growth in churches that are not just conservative morally, but that take the unseen world seriously, said Damick, who is also chief content officer of Ancient Faith Ministries, a pan-Orthodox publisher and media group. Many converts say they appreciate the notion that Orthodox theology and practices have remained the same since the birth of Christianity. As a joke recounted fondly in Orthodox circles puts it, how many Orthodox does it take to change a light bulb? The answer, change? What's that? The Orthodox Church stands as the hope of those who wish to be normal, to be healthy, true, and beautiful, said the Reverend David Wynn, the priest at All Saints. Wynn, 38, converted in the early 2010s. He has a seemingly endless energy for meeting with people curious about the church. His wife, Destiny, runs a popular Orthodox parenting account on Instagram when she is not homeschooling their four, soon to be five, children or hosting groups from the church on their big back porch overlooking a patch of woods in nearby Cary. Wynn arrived at All Saints in 2020, the year that many observers say was pivotal for the growth of Orthodox Christianity in the United States. Orthodox churches were significantly more likely than others to ignore the coronavirus pandemic and continue to hold in-person services. By 2023, in-person attendance at worship services had bounced back completely at the average Orthodox parish, while at other religious congregations it lagged behind, according to research published last year. Some Orthodox parishes now have their own schools, long a rarity in a tradition with such small numbers. The pan-Orthodox St. Constantine School has more than 500 students at its flagship school in Houston, which opened in 2015. The network opened a new campus in Pittsburgh last year and another in Dallas this fall. In North Carolina, All Saints is exploring the possibility of opening a school as well as adding a second priest and a new location. This fall, the parish had a record 165 catechumens, people in the typically year-long process of formally joining the Orthodox Church. The online influencers that many young men credit with introducing them to Orthodoxy speak directly about politics and culture in a way that parish priests more often avoid. They tend to share an unbending social conservatism with a particular interest in the traditional family and what they describe as the threats of feminism, homosexuality, and transgender identities. They are also generally opposed to the state of Israel. The Reverend Josiah Trenham, one of the most well-known American priests, appeared on Tucker Carlson's show shortly after the assassination of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk to discuss Christian mourning traditions. In a more recent video reflection on prominent white nationalist Nick Fuentes' appearance on Carlson's show, Trenham claimed he didn't know much about Fuentes and went on to praise the men's conversation about the scourge of pornography. Trenham's congregation in Riverside, California has more than 1,000 active parishioners and 241 in the process of converting. 5 years ago, I had 75, which I thought was a lot, he said in an interview this fall. The trajectory is increasing. Certain corners of the Orthodox internet are not just conservative or traditionalist, but openly racist and anti-Semitic, with several far-right figures converting in recent years. In the South, there is a strain of neo-Confederate orthodoxy that marries white supremacy and orthodox practice. Matthew Heimbach, who organized the notorious Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, has been excommunicated from the Antiochian Orthodox Church but joined another branch. Orthodox Christian writer Rod Dreher warned recently that anti-Semitism is spreading like a virus among religious conservatives of the Zoomer generation, including among the Orthodox. In interviews, parish priests said they see it as part of their jobs to acculturate ortho bros with extreme views to parish life, which they insisted was far removed from the violent rhetoric online. But critics say that top church leaders rarely condemn even the most noxious rhetoric from high-profile Orthodox Christians. From an institutional perspective, I get it. You're excited about growth, said Sarah Riccardi Swartz, an assistant professor of religion and anthropology at Northeastern University who has written about Americans who convert to Russian Orthodoxy. But when that growth comes with violent political tendencies, that is not good and it has to be checked. At All Saints, many young converts said they had become less invested in online orthodoxy the more they attended actual church. Austin Nolan, an accounting student, said his priest at his previous parish in Asheville, North Carolina, had warned him, "Don't be an ortho bro." Nolan, 21, and his fiancée Nadia Fuentes, 19, are now both catechumens at All Saints. After a packed Sunday service in August, they filed outside for an informal coffee hour. Nolan was raised as a Baptist and Fuentes as a Methodist, the two Protestant traditions that have dominated the religious landscape in the American South for generations. But the couple agreed that too many mainstream Protestant churches offered only shallow theology and far-left ideology. Fuentes' former church had a female pastor, which she said she didn't approve of, and she said she once saw a transgender woman, whom she described as a man, in the women's bathroom there during a Christmas service. There's just more validity in a church that can trace its lineage all the way back to the apostles, Nolan said. The couple said they were looking forward to raising an Orthodox family, one oriented around duty, truth, and objective beauty standards, Nolan said. In their future home, they are planning a prayer area facing east. This story was originally published in the New York Times. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.